Monday warrior, mean, mean stride. Today's Tom Sawyer, mean, mean pride.
Welcome back to Backbone Radio. I'm your host, Ross Kaminsky, joined by Kathleen Lacrone and Joshua Sharp behind the glass, and our special guest, Congressman Mike Kaufman, in studio with us. Mike, this lame duck session, as you said earlier, the duck was quacking a lot. The most active lame duck session of Congress since FDR, the first ever treaty passed during a lame duck session. And a lot of people think that it was sort of Barack Obama. I wrote a piece for the American Spectator that was, they titled it, Off the Ropes. Like a boxer was on the ropes and has come off the ropes. And the point of my piece was that I think his resurgence will probably give him some kind of false sense of security, and that the next Congress might not go as easy on him as the last few weeks have been. But you're in the trenches. What do you think?
Oh, I'm so excited because you know, on the tax, we had the tax bill came up, and I supported it because I felt we couldn't get a better deal on the tax side. I was upset about the extension of unemployment without any pay for. We should have reduced spending if we wanted to extend that out. I'm worried it's becoming more of a welfare program than anything else. But the great power of the United States House of Representatives is the president can't spend a dime, the executive branch can't spend anything unless Congress appropriates it. And the House alone can be in a blocking position for spending. And so, I mean, the power is in the House. And to change tax policy requires the signature of the president. But to cut spending just requires one house of either the U.S. The House or the Senate not to pass an appropriations bill. And so I think we could, you know, I think it's an exciting opportunity for Republicans, and the Republicans either better prove themselves or they're going to be out of office.
What's your take on the chances of a 1994-95 style government shutdown?
I don't know. Probably, I mean, it could very well happen. But I think the American people are not going to be. I think Bill Clinton won that in 1994 or after the 94 election. I'm not. I think the American people are very cognizant, and becoming increasingly so, that we really have a debt problem that's going to sink this country, and that wasn't the case in after the 94 election. That is the case now. So that's always a leverage, but I'm very excited about the prospects of just, you know, hammering the budget.
Well, tell us, speaking of hammering the budget, one of the committees you're on small business, natural resources, and armed services. And I want to talk about the last of those. Those were not listed in order of importance. It's a little bit unusual to hear Republicans talk about addressing cutting the defense budget. And, you know, I grew up in a military family living on military bases, but in my view, there's some work that needs to be done there. What's your take?
Well, I think, you know, it kind of reminds me when I was state treasurer and I took over a school district that had a lot of financial problems, and I cut their administrative budget by 45%. And I think they functioned better after that. Our military is so incredibly top-heavy, and I think that they've forgotten what their mission is. I think their mission, they think their mission is supporting the Pentagon, and it's projecting power abroad. I remember fighting with the Navy this year that they wanted to just, you know, mothball two ships because they wanted to save the operating costs and spend it on other things. And I said, well, isn't your job projecting sea power? I mean, isn't that what you're supposed to be about? Well, they got more admirals than they got ships. I just think that we are so top heavy now. So that's one issue, cutting the bureaucracy, keeping our warfighters there. But the other thing is, we've got to look and see and examine our foreign presence and say, do we really need four brigade combat teams in Europe? I mean, I was with the 1st Armored Division in Europe, in the United States Army in the 70s, in the height of the Cold War. You know, that's over. Why do we still have them there? We have 28,000 troops in Korea. But they're not along the demilitarized zone anymore. Is that really necessary to have that kind of presence there? Or can we demonstrate our support for South Korea by holding major exercises with them?
What about Okinawa? Right?
I think everything's got to be examined. in a cost benefit relationship to say, with given our ability to respond and to insert people fairly quickly, do we need that sort of, we can certainly have a forward presence, but we need that a force of that size over there. And when I meet with these combatant commanders, these four-star generals, I mean, it's like they're bureaucracies that want to protect their turf. It's like a slap in the face to pull anything away from them in relationship to their career, not the needs of the country. And so I think there's, and I got to tell you this, and I think this is going to be controversial, but it's an issue I want to look at. We're promoting people too fast, and they're not getting the kind of requisite experience that they ought to get in terms of really maximizing their warfighting capabilities in their respective grades before they're moved on. Well, that's a savings in the operating budget. We've got over 10,000 recruiters out there that are doing marketing jobs that are pulled out from their military occupational specialties. Couldn't that be better done by retired people, non-commissioned officers and officers, just like we had that junior ROTC program? And do we really need the Selective Service? I mean, it was put back in effect by the Carter administration in 1979 when the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. So we have this whole bureaucracy in place for the draft. Let's abolish that bureaucracy. The president can call it back into place by executive order if we need to.
So a lot of the military budget, Congressman Kaufman, is very expensive programs for very expensive military equipment. And I'm not complaining that equipment is expensive. We have the best equipment in the world, and we want to win. We want the best planes, the best ships, and whatever. But every once in a while, you come across these very large projects, a joint strike fighter or a second engine for an airplane. How do you deal with trying to get budgets for something like that cut when those numbers provide so many millions of dollars into one or two congressional districts where, you know, those congressmen, and then like Trent Lott was famous for it when he was still in the Senate, you could never cut anything that had a military budget in Mississippi. How do you fight that?
Well, it's tough. And I sided with the president on the second engine for the Joint Strike Fighter. I can't remember what the cost was, but it was tremendous. And I just really didn't feel that it was necessary, but it came down to it passed. Based on, it was a jobs bill. And, I think that's a problem. Now, we are losing, one of the arguments is we're losing our industrial base to China and overseas. And so it's hard to bring it back once you've lost it. But that's just not the way to do it. And so
My biggest question would be also is, so we start cutting the military and we save all this money. Where is that money going to go? Because what's going to happen is that budget will be cut, but will go into another social program. And I think that's where me, as an American citizen who says, hey, I don't mind if we make our military lean, but let's not make it lean so that something else can become fat.
Well, I'm never going to compromise our warfighting skills capability, but that's the other issue we have to look at. And that's, I think, having bought Paul Ryan as chairman of the budget committee, somebody I've got a lot of faith in that I'm going to be working with. What he's saying, and I believe, and this is absolutely right, we've got to cut entitlement spending.
Exactly.
And so defense is but a small part of that. But what is going to eat our lunch is not discretionary spending to include defense, but it's the entitlement programs, this mandatory spending.
Right.
That's going to eat our lunch. It's Medicaid, it's Medicare, it's Social Security, and all the other entitlement programs that have come about. We just had one that, I mean, it was a hard political vote for me. I voted against the 9/11 bill. But what the media wasn't saying about the bill, and it does create an entitlement program, was that we'd already spent over $7 billion for first responders.
Right.
This was really more about just not even the people that really worked on the site afterwards, but all the people living in the area that Congressional Budget Office said, how do you really, how can we really determine whether or not their health issue is related to
exactly that
toxic dust that was out there? But, I think it was a tough vote for a lot of people, because whenever you have to explain something, you're always on the defensive. And when you say you voted against the 9/11 bill for, responders, and it never sounds as good.
Well, I think you're in a good position on that, in the sense of having served in Iraq and served two branches of the military. No one's going to be able to call you soft on whatever for that particular vote. We got about a minute left in this segment. As far as cutting entitlements, it seems like Paul Ryan's roadmap has been one of the few reasonably well-known publicly, assaults on government spending. What's your take as to why he only has a dozen or so sponsors on that? And do you think that will change in this coming Congress? Is there political will to take on entitlements, even among Republicans?
Well, I think that I probably differ with him some on his Social Security part, where he talks about, the private accounts for Social Security. What I want to do with Social Security is, for those people at or near retirement, let them go forward. What we need to do is incentivize more savings. And I think to make it more of a means-tested safety net program. The same with Medicare, to say, these are the dollars that we have. This is the program we can make available. And so if I don't need it, then it's not there for me. If I need it, then it's there for me. And so I think we have a different view about that. I wouldn't want to raise the amount from where it is right now, the cap, or increase the tax.
Well, that's an interesting point. We have to hit a break. But when we come back, what I want to ask you then is, if you make Social Security so means-tested that someone of moderately high income, and congressmen make a good living, but it doesn't make you a multimillionaire, if your level of income would means-test you out of Social Security, doesn't that turn Social Security into welfare rather than how it was originally sold to the country as a retirement plan? Don't answer right now. We're going to hit this break. We'll be right back here on Backbone Radio on News Talk 710 KNUS and 1460 KZNT. Stay with us.
Now, back to Backbone Radio.
Welcome back to Backbone Radio, continuing our conversation with Congressman Mike Hoffman. Mike, before we hit that break, you were talking about the possibility of means testing Social Security as a way to essentially to decrease its unfunded liability and make it a sustainable program. And my question to you is, would that not turn Social Security into welfare?
Well, it's a safety net. I mean, the fact is that basically all Americans who earn a paycheck are going to be paying into it. And so it will be there then if you need it. And if you don't need it, it's not going to be there for you. But in the event that you do down the road, it's a safety net. So I think that's the only way to make it sustainable. And let's incentivize savings through tax policy to get people to save for their retirement. And so I think that, and again, people at or near retirement on Social Security, let's keep them on the system that they plan for. But for younger folks, the reality is it's not going to be there. And so we really need to allocate, those resources. And I don't think we can ever tax the American people high enough to be able to meet those obligations. People are, and there are other things that are going to have to be done too. I think the age is going to have to move up. As well, I think. So we're going to have to make a number of adjustments across the board in a number of entitlement programs, Medicaid as well, Medicare. And there's so many. At the end of the day, it's not discretionary spending, as sloppy as it is. It's going to eat our lunch. And that's increased in the last 2 years. 84% is non-discretionary defense spending. And if you subtract out the stimulus that just did so much for this economy, then you're down to 28%. 28% in 2 years, even if you don't include the stimulus, non-defense discretionary spending. I look forward to cutting that. But at the end of the day, again, we've got to deal with entitlement spending.
So I'll take that as a yes. It's a yes, that would make Social Security a welfare program.
A safety net. Let's message this properly.
Now let's talk about balanced budget. There's a balanced budget caucus in the House, of which you were co-chairman with a Democrat who is or was?
Jim Marshall out of Georgia, and he wasn't reelected.
So you were chairman now.
Is that because of his support of balanced budget?
You know, the sad part about it is that there were a lot of the real casualties on the Democrat side tended to be
conservative.
The more conservative to moderate, particularly in the South.
Yeah.
In the South, they were the more that you had conservative Democrats in red-leaning districts and sometimes pretty Republican districts, but who, by and large, were very fiscally conservative, and they were wiped out in this election.
Are you going to be able to find, are you going to try to find another Democrat to co-chair that with you to make it a bipartisan effort?
You know, I am. It's because it's going to take, we're going to have Democrats to get the necessary two-thirds vote to pass something. And so...
Two-thirds meaning you would expect Barack Obama to veto something?
Well, the great thing is it doesn't go, this would go straight to the people through the state legislatures, the ratification process. And so it bypasses the White House altogether. And that's obviously a big plus. He would never support balanced budget. Well, actually, when I formed the caucus, Pelosi came up with her version of what was a balanced budget amendment. And I took the version that passed passed the House in 1994 and failed in the Senate by one vote. So hers mirrored mine, except for one big thing. It didn't take into account any entitlement spending.
And so how balanced
was
that?
It's a fictional balanced budget amendment.
Now, if that would also have to get three-quarters of the states.
Right.
But couldn't you, you know, in your sleep, name more than a quarter of the states that are owned by Democrats and unions and wouldn't pass?
You know, I think that the country's really changing. And I tell you what, if you look, in looking at congressional redistricting, it is amazing. It is what you have is a migration to low tax, business friendly states where the jobs are, away from high tax, big government states. Particularly, look at the Northeast. Look at the Rust Belt.
Mm-hmm.
Look at those areas that have chased away jobs, and they've also chased away their citizens. And so I think that look at Christie, Governor Christie in New Jersey. I mean, he's popular in his state, and which amazes me. God bless him, but he's taken on the liberal establishment.
Right, and I suppose if Scott Brown can win in Massachusetts, then anything can happen. And we're going to talk about the census more later in the show. But basically only one Democrat state is getting a seat, and that's Washington, and that's a state with no state income tax. So there is a big, big message there for sure. What's going on with the Natural Resources Committee? Anything interesting to report that you expect in the next session with that?
Well, I think in the natural, what I want to work on, the big issue is on public lands. How can we stimulate, I don't think we need government subsidy, but how can we get government out of the way to have a regulatory process that's more streamlined so we get more oil and gas exploration and development in the United States to make us put us down the path to energy independence. The majority of our trade deficit right now is imported oil. We can produce oil and gas in this country as well as producing jobs to follow. And so I think there are great opportunities in this country that we can do it in an environmentally responsible way. But this notion of just say no to oil and gas development in the United States is I think, the wrong direction for this country.
We only have about 1 minute left. Let me ask you along those lines. A lot of what the Obama administration seems to be doing is stuff that it can't get through the Congress. It's going to try to do by regulation, like through the EPA. How can you, as the Congress, try to stop that?
You know, I'm real excited. By virtue of controlling the House, we will be able to, through the appropriations process, to block funding for some of the very agencies that he is using to, I think, usurp the power of Congress. In his cap and trade bill, he's trying to utilize the EPA to have an endangerment finding on carbon emissions, which was clearly not the intent of the Clean Air Act. So I think that we're going to be tough, whether it's the healthcare bill or in the 47 new agencies that are created under that bill, or it's looking at cap and trade and the Environmental Protection Agency. We scored a big win when the Senate rejected the omnibus spending bill, the porculous bill. That was a huge win because within that bill was the funding to start all the implementation of Obamacare.
That's right.
As well as a number of other things. So now we've got some real opportunities where we would have lost a year in terms of stopping this stuff. We now can have a lead on this.
Congressman Mike Kaufman, that's the end of our hour on the show. Thanks so much for taking time to come in and join us. Hope you had a great Christmas. Wish you a very Merry New Year. Looking forward to working with your new press guy when he comes in. And thanks again for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Tell Cynthia Merry Christmas as well.
I will. I will.
All right. We'll talk with you soon, Congressman.
Thank you.
Stay with us right here on Backbone Radio. When we come back after this break, we'll talk about a lot of things, including some of the famous and interesting people who passed away during the year 2010. Stay with us.